content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading from the October 6, 2017 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week has, I believe it's NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell standing in the center with his arms crossed and a firm look on his face. And there are a group of NFL football players, all in different uniforms, some in front of him, kneeling with their heads bowed, some standing behind him with their arms interlocked. And the title on the article or on the cover says Political Football: The Uproar Over Trump's Demand That the NFL Fire Protesting Players. And I believe, in fact, that is our first main story. NFL players defy Trump's demands. What happened? President Donald Trump has opened another front in America's deepening cultural wars, repeatedly calling on NFL franchise owners to fire players who kneel during the national anthem as a form of political protest. Speaking at a rally in Huntsville, Alabama, the president said last week that the handful of players who silently knelt during the anthem, a protest begun by quarterback Colin Kaepernick last season to highlight racial injustice and police treatment of black men, were displaying a total disrespect of our heritage. He said he wished owners would respond by saying, "Get that son of a bitch off the field right now. Out, you're fired." Trump doubled down on his comments in a series of 18 tweets over the next 4 days, calling for a boycott of the NFL and criticizing players for abusing the privilege of earning millions for playing sports. He also withdrew an invitation to the White House for reigning NBA champions, the Golden State Warriors, after star player Stephen Curry said his feelings about Trump made it unlikely he'd attend. In response to Trump's comments, more than 250 NFL players across the country knelt or sat for their pregame anthems, while others interlocked arms or remained in the locker room to show their support for free speech. Several owners joined the demonstration of solidarity, some of which elicited boos from fans, with even New England Patriots chief Robert Kraft, a Trump donor and supporter, saying he was deeply disappointed by the president's comments. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell said he was proud of how players, coaches, and owners responded to Trump's divisive rhetoric. What the editorial said: Trump is right on the core issue here, said NationalReview.com. Of course, football players should stand for the national anthem. Yes, the players have a legitimate grievance over the treatment of African Americans by police and the justice system. But the singing of the Star Spangled Banner is an all-too-rare moment of civic comity, a moment to display respect for a nation that continues to be a force for liberty, decency, justice, peace, and prosperity. The president's attacks on the NFL have nothing to do with patriotism or love of country, said USA Today. Rather, this was vintage Trump stoking flames of anger and resentment. He knew the anthem protest would be a ripe wedge issue. A majority of Americans think they're unpatriotic, but also accept the players' right to carry them out, and saw an opening to whip up his base. All hail the divider-in-chief. What the columnist said: Trump's attack on African-American athletes underscores the vital role of racist grievance in his core message, said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. When he called the players ungrateful for the privilege of making millions of dollars, he was reviving the Jim Crow-era slur, uppity. And he pointedly defined the two sides of this debate as us and them, turning a black player protest against police mistreatment into an assault on America itself. Right or wrong, this was a classic example of Trump's gut-level political savvy, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. He took a commonly held sentiment that disrespecting the anthem is wrong, but stated it in a way guaranteed to generate outrage among his critics and thus fire up his supporters. This kind of thing is why he's president. Sorry, but fellow conservatives cheering this as a win for Trump are missing the forest for the trees, said David French, also in NationalReview.com. This is the President of the United States demanding that a private company fire its employees because of free speech he doesn't like. That's a dangerous threat to the First Amendment, and it's why a tiny protest turned into a league-wide show of solidarity. Like it or not, Trump is doing exactly what he was elected to do, said David Brooks in the New York Times. He was elected to shred the dominant culture, defy the elites, and give voice to the resentments of the white working class who feel invisible and disrespected. His incitements, including the attack on black athletes, have made America as culturally and racially divided as it was in the late 1960s. By the time Trump is done, a new social fabric will have to be woven. That's the work of the next 20 years. Here's our controversy of the week. North Korea. Could the war of words lead to real war? This is the way a nuclear war begins, said Barbara Dimmick in the Los Angeles Times. Not with an epic struggle over ideology or territory, but with two emotionally stunted world leaders trading schoolyard threats and insults. The name calling started, unsurprisingly enough, with President Donald Trump, who in a speech last week to United Nations referred to North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un as Rocket Man and threatened to totally destroy North Korea if Kim doesn't abandon his pursuit of nuclear weapons. Kim replied by vowing to tame the mentally deranged U.S. doddered with fire when Trump sent B-1 bombers on a menacing mission off North Korea's coast. Kim's foreign minister said America's words and actions constituted a declaration of war and threatened to shoot down any U.S. warplane that even comes near the country. During a fiery speech at a rally in Alabama, Trump mocked Kim with the even more insulting nickname, Little Rocket Man, said Julie Hirschfeld Davis in NYTimes.com. The crowd gave a rapturous roar. But among foreign policy and national security experts, reactions ranged from nervous disbelief to sheer terror. It is possible we survived the Cold War just to careen into a nuclear confrontation driven by personal animosity and bravado. Trump's blunt threats have ruffled foreign policy sensibilities on the eastern seaboard, said Daniel Henniger in WSJ.com. But given Kim's insistent warnings that he was preparing to inflict nuclear Armageddon on a U.S. city, he needed a reminder that any move in that direction will get him wiped off the map. With the belligerent and erratic Kim building an arsenal and test-firing long-range missiles, we've entered a nuclear reality incomparably more dangerous than anything in the previous 7 decades. Unlike our former foes in the Soviet Union and China, Kim is not a rational actor, and he can't be reached with the diplomacy and positive incentives the U.S. has been offering him, his father, and grandfather for 24 years. Enough appeasement. Trump's tough talk is welcome. Actually, said Max Boot in ForeignPolicy.com, Trump's macho posturing could lead us straight into war. No sane leader hurls personal insults at his counterpart in a nuclear-armed state. If the paranoid and inexperienced Kim takes Trump's words seriously and then sees U.S. warplanes heading for his borders, he may assume an attack is underway and have his artillery open fire on Seoul. At that point, well, wars have a way of escalating. The verbal threats are a sideshow, said the New York Post in an editorial. What matters is action, and Trump has been tightening the screws on Kim. Just this week, Trump hit North Korea with a new round of sanctions, targeting not only its banks and industries, but also its overseas trading partners. China announced it will limit exports of oil and gas to Pyongyang and the ban of textile imports that are North Korea's main legal source of cash. Economic pressure will never force Kim to give up his nukes, said Steve Cole in NewYorker.com. But combined with diplomacy, it could persuade him over time to back off his threats of an attack. But the way the rhetoric between two thin-skinned national leaders is escalating, a miscalculation or accident could lead to hundreds of thousands of deaths. That's what ultimately makes the current standoff so unsettling. As these theatrically belligerent men threaten to plunge each other's people into hellfire, it's hard to know where performance ends and personality begins. And the controversy comes up in our good week, bad week shorts. It was a good week for vocabulary lessons after North Korean leader Kim Jong-un called President Trump a dotard, prompting an immediate spike in Google searches for the rarely used word, which means an old person, especially one who has become weak or senile. It was a good week for snake oil sales after actress-turned-lifestyle guru Gwyneth Paltrow opened a Goop Lab store in Los Angeles to sell such luxury products as sex dust, healing stones, and psychic vampire repellent, which is made from sonically tuned gem elixirs. And it was a good week for the verbose, after software engineers at Twitter announced a pilot program to test doubling the allowable character limit from 140 to 280. Many Twitter enthusiasts complained it would ruin the terse, witty tone of the platform, with one adding, "If you're upset, just imagine what John Kelly must be thinking." But it was a bad week for a cone of silence after Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt installed a customized $25,000 privacy booth in his office so that no one, including hackers and members of his staff, could listen in on his phone conversations. Pruitt has also amassed an 18-person security detail to guard him 24/7. It was a bad week for flat earthers after rapper B.O.B. launched a crowdfunding campaign to build a high-altitude satellite to prove that the earth is flat. "I'm looking for the curve," said the rapper. And it was a bad week for apocalypse planning after self-proclaimed biblical researcher David Meade amended his highly publicized claim that the world would end on September 23rd. "Wait until the middle of October," Meade said. "I don't believe you'll be disappointed." Before we move on, we'll read a boring but important piece. Interior Secretary accuses staff of disloyalty. In a speech to oil industry executives this week, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke said nearly a third of his agency's 70,000 employees are disloyal to President Trump. "I got 30% of the crew that's not loyal to the flag," Zinke told the National Petroleum Council. complaining that federal workers are dragging their feet on issuing permits for mining and drilling on public lands. Zinke promised huge changes that would speed permits and relax regulations, possibly by moving decision-making positions in the Bureau of Land Management and the Bureau of Reclamation from Washington, D.C. to western states. The president wants it yesterday, Zinke said, of the energy development permits. We have to do it by the law. The headline this week on the briefing page is The Persecution of the Rohingya. Government troops are slaughtering the Rohingya and driving them out of Myanmar. Why are these people so hated? What's going on? Hundreds of thousands of desperate Rohingya people are fleeing a vicious military purge in Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. Troops have burned scores of villages, beheading men, raping women, and even killing children. In some place, Buddhist militias and mobs have joined in the attacks against the Muslim-majority Rohingya. The Myanmar army and government call their assault a counter-terrorist operation, but the UN has labeled it a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. With more than 420,000 people chased into Bangladesh since August and tens of thousands following them every week, the exodus is the world's most rapid and intense refugee crisis since the 1994 Rwandan genocide. The influx of brutalized families has overwhelmed aid efforts, and thousands of hungry people are camping in the open, exposed to monsoon rains. About 60% are children, and many have lost their parents to massacres back home. The sheer scale of it is beyond belief, Thierry Tapa of Human Rights Watch told Newsweek. I've never seen a group this devastated, this destroyed. Who are the Rohingya? They are often described as the world's most persecuted people. Muslims have lived in the coastal Rakhine area, separated from the rest of Myanmar by a mountain range, since at least the 12th century. The Rohingya are believed to be descended from those early Arab and Mughal traders. But since populations have been driven back and forth across the border of what is now Bangladesh at least four times since the late 1700s, there was significant mixing with South Asian Muslims. During more than a century of British colonial rule from 1824 to 1948, many Muslims in what is now India and Bangladesh relocated to Burma, then a British Indian province, to work, and they too were absorbed into the Rohingya. The Rohingya language, Rohingyalish, is close to the Chittagongian dialect spoken in southern Bangladesh. Why do the Burmese reject them? Mistrust goes back decades and has its roots in ethnic and religious enmity as well as political differences. During World War II, the Rohingya supported the British while Burmese nationalists supported the Japanese. The British promised the Rohingya their own state but did not deliver. In 1948, the Rohingya were left in newly independent Burma amid a Buddhist majority that now saw them as disloyal and potentially dangerous foreigners. When a military junta took over Burma in 1962, it labeled the Rohingya Bengalis and excluded them from citizenship, leaving them stateless, with no access to government health care, education, or most jobs. Periodic waves of mass persecution over the following decades have given rise to a Rohingya resistance movement and growing radicalization among Myanmar's young Muslim men. In recent years, the radicals have formed the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army, ARSA, known locally as Al-Yakin, or the Faith Movement. How did the current purge begin? ARSA militants killed 9 border police last October. The enraged government sent troops pouring into Rakhine State, and refugees say the soldiers raped, killed, and burned their way through Rohingya villages. The current exodus began in earnest in August after ARSA militants attacked police posts, killing 12 and sparking the ongoing massive crackdown. Many fleeing Rohingya are furious at ARSA, who remain a small minority of their population. "We are the ones who are suffering because of Al-Yakin," said refugee Noor Kamal. "They disappeared after the attack. We were the ones left behind for the military to kill." Even the country's civilian leader, Nobel Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi, has cited the ARSA attacks in condemning the Rohingya as terrorists. What is Bangladesh's position? Bangladesh is one of the few countries that never ratified the UN Convention on Refugees and has consistently insisted that the Rohingya must return to Myanmar. Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina said last week that her country is currently sheltering more than 800,000 Rohingya. She has called on the UN to supervise safe zones in Rakhine so those families can return to their homeland in safety, security, and dignity. But that will be difficult. In the same speech, Hasina accused Myanmar of laying landmines along the border to prevent the Rohingya from returning. And the international community? The U.S., Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and other countries have strongly denounced Myanmar's crackdown and pledged millions in emergency aid. But Myanmar won't allow aid agencies in to help the 800,000 displaced Rohingya still trapped in Rakhine. Meanwhile, in Bangladesh, the UN Refugee Agency is rushing in supplies to feed and shelter the masses of people, mostly by expanding the existing camps housing Rohingya driven out in past purges. But caring for so many displaced people at once is an overwhelming challenge, and hunger and disease are rampant, while clean water and toilets are virtually non-existent. When you walk through the settlement, you have to wade through streams of dirty water and human feces, said Katie White, the emergency medical coordinator of Doctors Without Borders. A public health emergency could be just around the corner. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. We will take two from the U.S. this week. First, tax cuts don't pay for themselves. Humiliated by their failure to get anything else done, the GOP-led Congress has retreated into that great Republican safe space, tax cuts, said Kevin Williamson. Congressional Republicans are hoping to rally conservatives with a plan to reduce individual and corporate tax revenue by $1.5 trillion over 10 years without any corresponding cuts in spending. They argue they can do this in good conscience because the tax cut will generate so much economic growth that it will effectively pay for itself. But that isn't what happened after the Reagan tax cuts. Federal revenues shrank by $153 billion between 1981 and 1983 as the economy sank into recession, before robustly rebounding later. Contrary to supply-side dogma, the architects of Reagan's tax plan never expected his tax cuts to pay for themselves. They believed the growth effects would amount to only one-third of the lost revenue. Why should we expect more dramatic results now, when the economy is already growing and Trump's cut would be much smaller than Reagan's? We shouldn't. The proposed tax bill would probably add $1 trillion to the national debt. blindly hacking away at the tax code with a meat axe and then expecting pie-in-the-sky results is actually not conservative. America's Forgotten Center. My political views put me in the solid center, said Max Boot. Yet they've turned me into a political pariah, a man without a party. I'm socially liberal, in favor of LGBT rights, legal abortion, and immigration. But I'm fiscally conservative, think entitlement spending has to be brought under control, and believe we need to beef up our military to contend with multiple enemies. Which party represents this fairly commonplace combination of center-right views held by tens of millions of Americans? None. Under Donald Trump and other Pied Pipers of the far right, the Republican Party has become a party of cultural resentment and nihilism, organized around hatred of libtards and snowflakes. Much of the party's leadership and rank and file have become morally compromised because of their justification of Trump's unjustifiable racism and authoritarianism. But Democrats are moving leftward toward Bernie Sanders' European-style socialism with free goodies for everyone. Where does that leave the forgotten middle? What this country needs is a truly independent and charismatic candidate, not beholden to extremists who would chart a sensible, centrist path for America. What we need, in other words, is a sane Donald Trump. And speaking, yet again, of Mr. Trump, our in-depth article, The Last Word, is about him, and it's titled, A Loner by Choice. President Trump is increasingly isolated in the White House, alienated from Congress and cut off from old associates and allies, said journalist Michael Cruz. But throughout his life, he's trusted no one. Isolated, read the subject line. Friend, Donald Trump wrote recently to supporters in a fundraising email, the fake news keeps saying President Trump is isolated. They say I'm isolated by lobbyist corporations, grandstanding politicians, and Hollywood. Good. I don't want them, he fumed. Sent on August 28th, 2 days after Hurricane Harvey inundated Houston, Trump's defiant appeal acknowledged the mounting perception that 8 months into his first term, he's never been politically more lonely. He's at odds with Congress, including leaders and members of his own party, and his deal-making with Democrats is angering some of the most ardent conservative supporters. He's been abandoned and censured by art leaders, business leaders, and world leaders. His Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida is bleeding bookings, and he's losing favored aides because of the actions of his own chief of staff, General John Kelly, who restricts access to the president with the diligence of a border guard. Last month, the New York Times described Trump as a solitary cowboy, reminding readers he once called himself the Lone Ranger. His critics might see his growing isolation as a product of his political inexperience, but it's merely a continuation of a lifelong pattern of behavior for Trump. Take away the Pennsylvania Avenue address, the never-ending list of domestic and international crises, and the couldn't-be-higher geopolitical stakes, and this looks very much like Trump throughout his entire existence. Isolated is how he's always operated. The middle son of a stony, workaholic father with whom he had an almost business-like relationship, Trump is a double divorcee a boss with a professed distaste for having partners or shareholders, a television-tethered hamburger-eating homebody, and a germaphobe who has described shaking hands as a terrible, barbaric, and one of the curses of American society. He's been a loner most of his life. At New York Military Academy, everybody knew him, but few of his fellow cadets knew him well. In college, he made no friends he kept. After he moved to Manhattan, he lived in a sealed-off triplex penthouse, relied on a small family-first cadre of loyalists, and mainly made more enemies than allies. At his casinos in Atlantic City, he was adamant about not mingling with the gambling masses. He was and is a lonely man, Jack O'Donnell, said Jack O'Donnell, a former Trump casino executive. One of the loneliest people I've ever met, biographer Tim O'Brien said in an interview. He lacks the emotional and sort of psychological architecture a person needs to build deep relationships with other people. It's been this way always because he's always been foundationally, virulently untrusting. There's a wall Donald has that he never lets people penetrate, a former associate told me. Trump has a dark, dour view of humanity. He considers the world ruthless, brutal, and cruel. Seen through this zero-sum dog-eat-dog lens, friends aren't friends. There's no such thing. They act nice to your face, but underneath, they're out to kill you. He wrote in his 2007 book, Think Big. They want your job, they want your house, they want your money, they want your wife. Why he's like this is the subject of vigorous discussion among psychology experts. The deep-seated influence of his formidable father, the wound of the alcohol-fueled death of his more mild-mannered older brother, simple genetics. Trump is not self-reflective. I don't like to analyze myself because I might not like what I see, he told a biographer several years back. But he can be self-aware. And on this front, he's been quite clear and consistent. My business is so all-encompassing, I don't really get the pleasure of being with friends that much, frankly, he said to one interviewer in 1980. The first people who really noticed Trump's tendency to withdraw were his classmates. As a teenager at New York Military Academy, he often disappeared into his solo room in the barracks after dinner. The reason I went in the first place, Trump himself would say later, was that I didn't get along with a lot of people. Pictures in yearbooks show Trump morphing from a gangly boy to a sturdy young man, but this much didn't change. Classmate Doug Reichel characterized him to me as very distant. I don't know anyone that he was particularly close to, said Ernie Kirk, another classmate who is now an attorney in Georgia. He was so competitive, according to a former roommate, that everybody who could come close to him, he had to destroy. You just couldn't be friends with him, said Sandy McIntosh, who was 2 years younger but knew him from home, too, because their families both had cabanas at the Atlantic Beach Club on Long Island. Trump wouldn't laugh at his jokes, or anybody else's, McIntosh recalled. And you think of humor as a basic, empathetic way that friendships are formed. And he just didn't. It was the same way at Fordham University in the Bronx, where Trump spent his freshman and sophomore years of college playing on the squash team and wearing a three-piece suit to class. Trump and Brian Fitzgibbon sometimes carpooled to school because their families both lived in Queens. They were friendly, Fitzgibbon said in an interview, but not friends. I can't recall any real friendships he had at Fordham, he said. When Trump transferred from Fordham to the University of Pennsylvania, he left without telling people goodbye. And it was no different either down in Philadelphia, where he studied real estate at Wharton and boasted in class that he would be bigger than then nonparallel developer Bill Zeckendorf. But for the most part, one classmate told the Daily Pennsylvanian, Trump was really off by himself. He didn't participate in extracurricular activities or go to the fraternity parties or football games. He returned every weekend to New York to work for his father, collecting rents at his outer borough apartment buildings. His footprint at Penn was virtually zero, classmate Lou Colomaris told me. I don't think he had any best friends. I never saw him pal around with anyone, quite frankly. The whole of the 80s were heady for Trump. He built Trump Tower, his masterwork, until The Apprentice led to the Oval Office. The Art of a Deal was a runaway bestseller, and he talked about running for president. Even his failures, like his ownership of the New Jersey Generals of the second-rate United States Football League, were successes of a sort because they boosted his national renown, which was actually the point from the start. And yet, as ascendant and ubiquitous as he was, Trump was fairly friendless, too. It wasn't just high society, said George Arts, a veteran-connected New York politico. Most of the real estate industry separated themselves from him. Arts told me his personality rubbed people the wrong way. Friendship is not a part of his agenda, a Trump business associate told Newsweek in 1987. Trump didn't disagree. I hate to have to rely on friends, he said. I want to rely on myself. His only real friends, he added, were family members. By early 1990, as Trump confronted self-inflicted financial calamity and marital failure, Connie Chung of CBS questioned his solitary nature. Do you have a best friend? She asked. Well, I have so many different friends, Trump said, and it'd be hard to say a best friend. Is your wife a best friend? She's a great friend. I have a father who's a great friend. I mean, is there somebody that you really confide in? I tend not to confide. I really tend not to confide. I'm very closed in that sense. I think that's my own maybe guarded mechanism. Is it that you don't trust people? I don't trust people, no, Trump said, self-assessing in the most explicit possible terms. I'm a non-trusting person. On newsstands nationwide at the time of the interview was an extensive conversation in Playboy. In it, Trump echoed something he had discussed with Chung, too, the death of his older brother, Fred Trump Jr., and its lasting effects. His brother had been too trusting with too many people, a fatal mistake in Trump's estimation, and he had been taken advantage of, and that had led to his alcoholism and finally his demise at only 43 years old. The lesson I learned, Trump concluded, was always to keep up my guard 100%, whereas he didn't. He ended up later in the interview musing about the prospect of a President Trump. He wouldn't trust anyone, Trump said. Periodically over the past few months, I have found myself thinking back to 1990. It was the moment before the current moment when Trump seemed the most isolated and alone. His business was listing, and he was losing inner circle loyalists. His marriage was over. His oldest son, then 12, angry and hurt, wasn't speaking to him. It would later be reported. In telephone public opinion polls, readers of New York tabloids were siding overwhelmingly with his wife, not him. The early portion of that year has always seemed to me to be an unusual and even unique stretch in the scope of Trump's life. Rewatch that Connie Chung interview and reread the Playboy conversation, and he presents as not only irritable, but also rattled, vulnerable, or at least his version. Even his book that came out in 1990, Surviving at the Top, is in my mind different from all the other books he's put out over the decades. It has plenty of platitudes, too, but there's also in the text and between the lines a certain detectable pathos. That spring, according to Vanity Fair, Trump holed up in Trump Tower in an apartment separate from his soon-to-be ex up in the penthouse, ordering in burgers and fries, his belly getting soft, his hair getting long, staying on his back in his bed, staying up late, calling people to talk, staring at the ceiling. You remind me of Howard Hughes, a friend told him. Thanks, Trump said. I admire him. He wrote about the tycoon turned neurotic hermit in Surviving at the Top. The Howard Hughes story is fascinating to me, Trump told readers, because it shows that it's possible to fall very far, very fast. As time goes on, I find myself thinking more and more about Howard Hughes and even, to some degree, identifying with him. He cited Hughes' aversion to germs and the downsides of fame, such as when he's approached in restaurants and people end up spraying their good wishes all over my food. Every time that happens, Trump wrote, Howard Hughes and his reclusive lifestyle look a little less crazy to me. Journalist Wayne Barrett, who started reporting on Trump in the late 1970s, addressed Trump's interest in Hughes in his seminal 1992 biography. Over the years, Barrett wrote, he had openly toyed with a final surreal twist to the plot that had become his life. He told friends that he might end up a Howard Hughes-like recluse, squirreled away, allowing his fingernails to grow longer than his stubby fingers. That poignant script may have appealed to the loner quality in him that had always kept him apart. The Hughes scenario only worked, though, if he could figure out a way back to the top. He did. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Politico.com. We are on the health and science page now. We'll take a couple of short pieces today. The lead article says, football harms young brains. Children who play football before age 12 are much more likely to suffer emotional, behavioral, and cognitive problems later in life than those who take up the game when they're older, the Washington Post reports. Neuroscientists from Boston University conducted a series of cognitive tests on 212 people who played football at various levels, high school, college, and professional. The people who started playing before 12 were twice as likely to have problems with self-control and executive functions, including judgment and problem-solving, and three times as likely to develop symptoms of depression. These effects appeared regardless of how long and to what level they went on to play. The younger they started, the worse the risk. The researchers noted that concussions weren't the only issue. The normal impacts that occur with blocking, tackling, and crashing to the turf have damaging cumulative effects. Between the ages of 10 and 12, there is a period of incredible development of the brain, said co-author Robert Stern. Perhaps that is a window of vulnerability. It makes sense that children whose brains are rapidly developing should not be hitting their heads over and over again. Amid growing evidence linking football to neurological disease, participation in the sport among boys ages 6 to 12 has dropped 20% since 2009. The health scare of the week, DNA altered by childhood. Childhood events can permanently affect our DNA and lead to diseases in adulthood, new research suggests. The genome's DNA sequence is essentially locked in at conception, but individual genes can be switched on or off by epigenetic processes in response to the environment. To investigate this mechanism, researchers studied the backgrounds and early experiences of more than 500 children. The researchers then analyzed 114 genes associated with inflammation, which can affect a person's risk for heart disease and other age-related conditions. They found that the expression of 9 of those genes was closely linked to certain childhood variables, such as socioeconomic status, duration of breastfeeding, and absent parents. Lead author Thomas McDade of Northwestern University says these epigenetic processes are a double-edged sword. We could have genes in our bodies that might lead to some bad outcomes, he tells SmithsonianMag.com. But if those genes are silent, if they're turned off due to epigenetic processes, that can be a good thing. And we are on the talking points page now. We'll start with Puerto Rico, a growing catastrophe. A week after Hurricane Maria tore through Puerto Rico, the U.S. territory is in the grip of a serious, life-threatening crisis, said Brian Resnick in Vox.com. Maria's 150-mile-per-hour winds and torrential rains utterly destroyed the territory's infrastructure, wiping out most crops and wrecking almost the entire power grid. It could take months for power to be restored, and cell service is also down, leaving much of the island incommunicado. While the population of 3.4 million is running out of fuel, medicine, food, and fresh water. As panic grows, many have been openly wondering when help will arrive, said Samantha Schmidt and Joel Achenbach in The Washington Post. Puerto Rico Governor Ricardo Rossello this week pleaded for more help from the federal government in Washington, warning that the territory's U.S. citizens were on the brink of catastrophe. Puerto Rico is fast turning into a Katrina moment for President Trump, said Philip Carter in Slate.com. When Hurricanes Harvey and Irma pummeled Texas and Florida this summer, tens of thousands of troops and government officials immediately snapped into action, with Trump flying in to pledge a full recovery. But the administration took days to respond to Puerto Rico and sent far fewer emergency and military workers. Trump was too busy posting 17 tweets about his feud with the NFL to say anything about the crisis, until mounting criticism prompted him to send out tweets that appeared to blame Puerto Rico for its own misery. He said the island was in terrible shape even before Maria hit because of broken infrastructure and massive debt, which he said must be dealt with. The truth is that the political and economic model for Puerto Rico wasn't working before Maria and is now permanently broken, said Tyler Cowan in Bloomberg.com. The semi-independent island has $123 billion in pension and debt obligation. Its younger population is steadily moving away, and Maria will badly damage its tourism industry and struggling economy. For the island to survive, full U.S. statehood is necessary, but the Republicans who control Washington will not permit it. Meanwhile, the situation on the ground is increasingly bleak, said Geraldo Rivera in FoxNews.com. Only an approach like the Marshall Plan that resurrected Europe in the wake of World War II can save this place. So come on, President Trump. Our fellow citizens need us. Kimmel, when comedians take on U.S. senators. Behold, the nation's new authority on health care policy. Jimmy Kimmel, said Jay Caruso in WashingtonExaminer.com. The liberal late-night host has been leading the crusade to protect Obamacare after revealing in April that his newborn son had a congenital heart defect. During the GOP's latest attempt to repeal and replace Obama's failing health care law, one of the bill's architects, Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican from Louisiana, even created the Jimmy Kimmel test. Any replacement bill would have to provide adequate health care for a child like Kimmel's. But in a sanctimonious monologue, Kimmel recently accused Cassidy of breaking his promise and said his bill would have let insurers charge people with pre-existing conditions far more. In reality, said David Harsanyi in NationalReview.com, the bill would have required any state that opted out of Obamacare's pre-existing condition rule to provide adequate and affordable health insurance coverage. Celebrities like Kimmel should drop the cheap zero-sum emotionalism and leave policy to the experts. Kimmel may be no healthcare expert, said Dan Diamond in Politico.com, but he was right. Cassidy broke his promise. The adequate and affordable phrase in the Cassidy-Graham bill was so vague as to mean nothing and would have allowed states to bring back the high-risk pools and sky-high premiums for pre-existing conditions that Obamacare got rid of. Kimmel was also correct in stating that the GOP bill would have resulted in tens of millions fewer people being insured overall. The real problem, said Daniel Dresner in the Washington Post, is not that comedians are aspiring to wade into public policy. It's that Republicans and President Trump tried to force through a heartless bill whose impact on real people they either didn't understand or didn't care to know. Kimmel certainly isn't the first comedian to wade into politics, said Theodore Kupfer in NationalReview.com. David Letterman and Jay Leno often lampooned Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. George Carlin was perpetually outraged by all politicians. But even at their rawest, these guys were telling jokes and at least trying to be funny. They didn't act like public intellectuals delivering long, earnest sermons on specific policy questions, like Kimmel and his late-night brethren John Oliver and Stephen Colbert. In the era of Trump, it's apparently time for comedians to get serious, and to the detriment of both good policy and good jokes. Private jets. Prices, expensive habit. Tom Price, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, is a longtime proponent of slashing entitlements, said the New York Times in an editorial. He might consider starting with his own. Politico.com reported last week that the former Republican congressman had used a taxpayer-funded private jet at least 26 times since May, at an eye-popping cost of $400,000. Price wasn't journeying to remote lands. He was flying to cities such as San Diego and Nashville that are extensively served by commercial airlines. On one trip, Price took a private jet to the glamorous Aspen Ideas Festival, a leisurely 19 hours before his speaking slot. He even spent an estimated $25,000 flying the 150 miles between Washington and Philadelphia, when an Amtrak ticket could have been had for less than $100. The flights are now under investigation by his department's inspector general, and Price has agreed to travel commercial until that review is complete. Even for conservatives who support this administration, Price's behavior is indefensible, said Guy Benson in townhall.com. The guy claimed to be a fiscal hawk. Can you imagine the howls of outrage from the right if Obama's cabinet secretaries had wasted taxpayer money jetting around like Hollywood stars? President Trump won the election by promising to stick up for the little guy, said Philip Wegman in WashingtonExaminer.com. So Price's flagrant profligacy feels like an insult to everyone who punched the GOP ticket. In normal, non-bizarro America, the HHS secretary would have to resign, said Michael Cohen in the Boston Globe. But in Trump's administration, feeding from the government trough is so commonplace that America's outrage meter is broken. Price was confirmed by the Senate even after it emerged that he had voted on, sponsored, and actively lobbied for legislation that could directly affect more than $300,000 in health care stocks he owned. Environmental Protection Agency's Chief Scott Pruitt is under departmental investigation over his frequent travel home to Oklahoma. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin even requested a military jet to ferry him and his wife around Europe on their honeymoon. Then, of course, there's the president himself, who is blatantly profiting off the foreign officials who stay at his overpriced hotel in Washington and the federal officials who stay at his Mar-a-Lago and golf resorts. Draining the swamp has been replaced by, let's frolic in the swamp. And a few shorter notes as we wind down the hour. The U.S. actually taxes its citizens less than almost any other developed nation. Of the 35 Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development countries, only South Korea, Ireland, Chile, and Mexico collect less taxes than the U.S. as a share of GDP. North Korea's rocket launches have prompted Lufthansa and Scandinavian Airlines to change their Asia-Pacific flight routes amid concerns over an accidental strike. The Marine Corps has made history by graduating its first female infantry officer. The woman, who has asked to keep her identity private, passed the Corps' grueling 13-week infantry officer course this week. Since the course was open to women, at least 30 female soldiers have attempted it and failed. At least $7.75 million of the $106 million raised for Trump's inaugural committee came from NFL owners and the league. And on the poll watch, 57% of Americans disagree with President Trump and say the NFL should not fire players who kneel during the national anthem, but there's strong partisan division on the issue. 82% of Democrats say the players should not be fired, while only 29% of Republicans think the same. Also on the poll watch, just 54% of Americans know that Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens. And let's see, we'll finish with a quote from Maya Angelou, quoted in brainpickings.org. She says, "There is nothing quite so tragic as a young cynic, because it means the person has gone from knowing nothing to believing nothing." We have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen again next time. I am Fred Woodward, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.